We're about to start, and today we're happy to have Anindya Sinha. He's a postdoc in string theory. And well, of course, as you know, he was supposed to give us two lectures, but one of them had to be canceled. So I asked him to give us more of a general talk about string theory. So hopefully this is going to be a lot of fun, and you will find many exciting things and interesting pictures. And okay, I'll meet you with Anindya.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you about the final frontiers of physics, which is string theory and holography. And so please feel free to stop me at any point of time if you want clarification about anything. The idea is that I'm going to talk about the ideas of holography. And the good part of my lecture is that there. There will be no example sheet. Okay. So let me begin by reviewing some basic ideas, which maybe you're familiar with or maybe you're not. So let me begin by discussing what are called Planck units. Can any of you tell me what Planck units are? Of course, the answer is there, but do all of you know what Planck units are? Yes, related to smallest possible lengths, yes. So Planck units are units of length, mass, time, charge, and temperature. And so these all carry this subscript p. And they're constructed out of these five fundamental constants, the velocity of light, c, the Newton's constant g, h bar, 4 pi epsilon naught is the vacuum permittivity, and k is the Boltzmann constant. You have a question? Oh, no. High five. Okay. Okay, so what is the physical significance of these Planck units? So the Planck mass is the mass for which the Schwarzschild radius is the same as the Compton wavelength. So what's the Schwarzschild radius? Any idea? That's right. Yes. So you may remember. So the metric. You may have been told about this. So the Schwarzschild radius is the radius at which this coefficient becomes zero. So R Schwarzschild is 2gm by c squared. Yes. Yes. As far as I can, I know. They will be online, right? Okay. So this is the energy scale at which the quantum properties are comparable with the general relativistic properties of the particle. So you cannot use just GR or quantum mechanics to study the properties or the physics of this particle. You require a quantum theory of gravity to understand these length scales. And yes, so I should have told you that the picture. So the picture on the right is that of Max Planck, after whom these Planck units are named. And you may know that the value of the Planck mass, so this works out to be square root of h bar c divided by the Newton's constant, is 10 to the 19 GeV. And in terms of kilograms, it works out to be roughly 10 to the minus 8 kilograms. And this Planck length, so this is the up to a proportionality constant, this is the unique length scale that can be constructed out of h bar, g, and c. This works out to be 10 to the power minus 35 meters. So to put all this into context, if you consider the mass of a flea, small insect, it's 5,000 times the Planck's mass. But its size is many, many times bigger than the Planck length. It's 10, 33 times the Planck length.
Okay. So let me go on to some quick review of the some of the basics. So you must have learned in the previous lectures that a black hole in general relativity essentially is a singularity in the equations covered by an event horizon. And these black holes have entropy. So do you know that black holes carry entropy? Have you been told this?
Okay.
So the subscript BH stands for either black hole or Bekenstein-Hawking. So Bekenstein and Hawking postulated that black holes carry entropy. And the formula for the black hole entropy is given by this. So it's the Boltzmann constant times the area divided by 4 times the Planck length square. And the fact that the entropy is proportional to area is very important for the purpose of this talk. So you should remember from this slide that the area of a black hole, the entropy of a black hole is proportional to the area. Now, we also have a microscopic description of entropy. So can anyone tell me what the microscopic formula of entropy is? Not really. Do you know the formula for the statistical entropy? Yes. Yes. So what is it?
K1.
That's right. So the microscopic entropy is the Boltzmann constant times the log of this this quantity omega. Can anyone tell me what this omega means?
The weighting. Yeah.
The weighting of what?
I don't know.
That's right. So this omega is the total number of microscopic configurations resulting in this macroscopic description, thermodynamic description. Okay? So, of course, one question is, okay, you have a black hole, you know that it carries some entropy, so how do you determine what microstates or microscopic configurations results in this? And the answer, one of the answers, I should say, being a perimeter, is you shrink it. There's another approach. There's another parallel approach that many researchers in perimeter follow. That's called loop quantum gravity. And that also has an answer to this question. OK, so the second question that one can ask from all this is that what is the significance of this area difference? The answer is, it gives rise to this concept of holography, which is going to be essentially the focus of my talk. So before I proceed, let me actually tell you about some of the buzzwords that I might inadvertently use in my lecture. QFT. The answer is already there. QFT stands for quantum field theory. Have you heard of quantum field theory? Okay. So essentially, quantum field theory is a theoretical framework for constructing quantum mechanical models of field-like systems or many-body systems. So you don't require to really know many details about quantum field theory, but just know that sometimes inadvertently I will use QFT, the short form, and it stands for quantum field theory. Another buzzword. That I'll use is CFT, and CFT stands for conformal field theory. So this is something that you may not have heard of. This is actually a special type of quantum field theory that is invariant under a special symmetry called conformal symmetry. So you just need to know this buzzword. There is no need to actually know too much about the details of this. Okay, QCD. You must have heard of QCD. Have you heard of QCD? QCD stands for quantum chromodynamics. So it's essentially the theory of strong interactions. So there are four fundamental forces. Can anyone tell me the four forces? Not you. How about you? What are the four fundamental forces? Give it a go. Give it a guess. You know two of them at least. You've studied them.
No clue.
Gravity, electromagnetism?
Sure.
Okay. What are the other two? Yes.
Strong and weak nuclear forces.
Very good. Very good, yes. So QCD is the theory of the strong force. Okay. So the other thing that I sometimes refer to is something called color. And color is something like an electric charge. It's present in quarks and gluons. So you know that nuclei are made out of protons and neutrons. Protons and neutrons are made of quarks. And the quarks are bound together by these things called gluons. And they carry something like an electric charge, and it's called the color charge. OK. There's going to be one slide where I'm going to use this terminology UVIR. So what this means is UV stands for ultraviolet, and IR stands for infrared. And if you remember, I tell you that ultraviolet corresponds to high energy or short wavelengths, and infrared corresponds to low energy or long wavelengths. Okay. There's something else that I'll be using once in a while, or referring to once in a while, and that's called perturbation theory. Okay. Can anyone tell me what perturbation theory means? Yes.
You want me to say?
Yes.
You take a stable point, typically, if you do it with an unstable point, bad things happen. And you perturb it slightly around that, take an expansion. There's different ways of doing it in different
ways. Yes. It's more or less typically roughly the correct idea. So the idea that in physics, the kind of idea that we want you to have is that you want to solve, say, you want to solve Schrodinger's equation. So Hamiltonian in one dimension looks something like that. So name one potential where you know the solution exactly. Anyone? Give me an example of a potential that the solution is known exactly. Good, very good. So one example of a potential that even I would have used is the harmonic oscillator. But then, so this is a very ideal example. So in real life, life is not so easy. You actually, the potential, typical potentials look much more complicated. Typically, you'd have some additional term like x to the 4 in the potential. Now, when you try and solve the Schrodinger equation for this, it's no longer possible to solve this exactly. The only way that you can solve it is by using this perturbation series. So what that means is that you expand the eigenvalues by assuming that lambda is small. So you have something that is has no dependence on lambda. So this will be the eigenvalue corresponding to purely the simple harmonic oscillator. And then you have higher order terms. Each of these are weighted by powers of lambda. Okay? Now, this method actually assumes that lambda is small. If lambda was big, so lambda was out of order 1, then of course this would break down. Now, okay, so lambda, you should, is also sometimes referred to as a coupling mod. Okay. So this coupling constant is something that measures the strength of an interaction and needs to be small for perturbation theory methods to be valid. Okay. So there's another very frequently used buzzword that's called gauge symmetry. And this gauge symmetry is a special kind of symmetry. And for the purpose of this lecture, you just need to remember that standard model has got this SU3 times SU2 times U1 gauge group. Just remember the buzzwords. There's no need to, for this lecture, there's no need to know the detail. And finally, there's something called supersymmetry. And supersymmetry is a special symmetry saying that the number of bosons and fermions are the same at each energy level. So you have a photon. Photon is the carrier of electromagnetism. You have a, so that's supposed to be a boson. So it's got an integer spin. Supersymmetry tells us that it has got a it's got a fermionic partner. It's called a Fortino. Okay. So since I'm going to tell you about holography, I should tell you about what a hologram is. Okay. From this, okay, so the anybody know who the person on the right is? On the right, extreme right?
Very good. Of course, you know. Yes. So the first person on the right is Dennis Gabor. He invented the hologram in 1947, and he got the Nobel Prize for that. Okay, now I expect all of you to know who that person is in the middle. Was it? Very good. So that's Sir Ian McKellen, who played the role of Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. Okay, any guesses for which one is the photograph and which one is the hologram? Yes.
Very good. Exactly. The left-hand one is the hologram, because if you observe closely, you can make out there is some perception of depth. You can make out some more features than you can on the right. The right is the ordinary photograph, two-dimensional photograph, and the thing on the left is the hologram. Maybe a better example is the following. So all this, by the way, I have taken from the internet, so if you want the references, I can easily give it. So this is, okay, Greek mythology. Anybody knows who this is? Yes. And so this is a nice example of a hologram. You're just rotating it, and you can clearly perceive depth in this slide. Okay. So what is the difference between a hologram and a conventional photograph? So compared to a conventional photograph, a hologram is able to record three-dimensional information. It's able to record depth. And it achieves so by recording the relative phases of coherent light reflected from the object. So in effect, it stores three-dimensional information on a two-dimensional surface. Okay? So there's an analogous idea, and this is actually the idea that I'm going to present, that prevails in quantum gravity and goes by the name of hologram. Okay. So this is a picture in Scientific American from an article called The Illusion of Gravity by Juan Malacena. So Juan Malacena is actually the one of the inventors of holography in string theory. He actually realized this concept of holography in string theory. And so this shows a clown who's juggling. So that there is an image that is projected on a sphere that is surrounding the clown. And you may not be able to read what is written. You need the program, so let me read that out to you. It says, holographic theory relates one set of physical laws acting in a volume with a different set of physical laws acting on the boundary surface. And here it is represented by the juggler and her colorful two-dimensional image. The surface laws involve quantum particles that have color charges and interact very much like the quarks and gluons of standard particle physics. The interior laws are a form of string theory and include the force of gravity experienced by the juggler, which is hard to describe in terms of quantum mechanics. Nevertheless, the physics on the surface and the interior are completely equivalent in spite of their radically different descriptions. So the idea of this lecture is going to try and explain somewhat better what this picture has to convey. Okay, so let me go on to some string theory basics. So here is a quick timeline for the origins of string theory. This could be charted back to 1921, essentially, where Kaluza and Klein came up with their idea of doing general relativity in five dimensions. And what they found is that when they considered reducing this theory down to four dimensions, they got magically left magnetism out of it. Okay, so they were able to unify gravity and electromagnetism by considering general relativity in five dimensions. But essentially, the birth of string theory was in the 1970s, and this arose because people wanted to understand something called dual resonance models. And supersymmetry, so this is the symmetry that relates bosons and fermions, was born in 1971. Then there was a hiatus because
a better theory came along which could explain the strong interactions, and that was QCD, quantum chromodynamics, in 1973. And people lost interest in trying to use string theory as a theory of strong interactions. But in 1974, it was realized that string theory, so when you consider closed strings, string theory has a massless spin 2 particle, and it was natural to identify this as graviton. So graviton is a carrier of gravity, the force carrier of gravity. And so people started thinking whether it's possible to think about string theory as a theory of gravity and as a unified theory, so which encompasses many forces. Then in 1976, people were able to unite gravity and supersymmetry, and they got something called supergravity. In 1980, they unified supersymmetry and string, so you can follow a trend, the idea of putting supersymmetry to everything. And they got superstrings. But in the first major breakthrough in string theory came in 1984. Actually, people got really excited after 1984. And this, what happened in 1984 is frequently referred to as the first string revolution, where people were able to show that there are these nasty things called anomalies which get canceled in string theory. And there was a furious flurry of activity from here. This paper that was written in 1984 received loads and loads of citations. People got tenure and so on. And so it's very ironic that one of the proponents actually found it very difficult to get tenure, but as soon as this paper got released, he was full professor. Okay. In 1987, people came out with this particular kind of string theory called exotic string theory, and they thought that this could be one way of explaining dark matter. In 1993, Gerard Tuft, have you heard of Tuft? Okay. He got the 1999 Nobel Prize for physics. And Lenny Susskind, Lenny Susskind is actually an associate member of Perimeter Institute. They introduced this idea of holography, which I will try and explain. In 1994 came the second string revolution, where B-brains were invented. Have you heard of B-brains? Yes, very good. And people realized that a priori where you had 5 different string theories, and the fear was that it would, which string theory are you supposed to use to describe nature? But these 5 different string theories worked out to be related by various kinds of dualities, and they were a part of this mother theory called M theory. In 1996, something miraculous happened, because for the first time, a statistical derivation, so this using the scale of omega, people were able to identify what the microstates that make up a black hole are. And then in 1997, another very major progress occurred in string theory, where for the first time, there was a concrete realization of this idea of holography in string theory. Okay, so let me continue with this quick summary of string theory. So here you have a mosquito. Mosquitoes are made of molecules. That actually could be an ant as well. Yes, probably an ant. So it's made of molecules, and one thing that is present everywhere is water. Water has hydrogen and oxygen. Oxygen is made up of electrons and protons and neutrons. And you zoom in, you know that protons and neutrons are made of quarks. And the current idea is that these quarks are nothing but some specific vibrational mode of a string. At this point, I'm supposed to show you 2 movies. Okay, so I'm showing you these 2 movies because there was this competition by the Discover magazine, and people were asked to come up and trying to explain string theory in 2 minutes. And there were these lovely movies that resulted from that. So let me show you what I firstly the movie that I personally feel conveys the idea of string theory the best. And then
modern physics is dominated by 2 camps. The first upholds Einstein's relativistic model of the universe, an improvement over Newton's immutable mechanics, which ticked to a universal clock and could accurately predict all events. The other supported quantum mechanics, which describes the weirdness at the subatomic level, and whose major tenet is that both location and energy of a particle cannot be known without an inherent degree of uncertainty. Relativism and quantum mechanics are reliable and mutually exclusive theories that share a major problem. Both can't be right, and neither describes the overall universe or explains gravity. Enter string theory, a new model for describing the fundamental particles and their behavior from the microverse to the macroverse. It could really be a component to the theory of everything. Like the unification of light, electricity, and magnetism, so too should gravity be combined. But grand unification hasn't been possible until string theory, which appears to be able to link not only the gravitational and electromagnetic forces, but also the weak and strong nuclear forces. It states that the fundamental constituents of reality are super small strings of the order of the Planck length, about 10 to the negative 35 meters, which vibrate at specific resonant frequencies. Any particle should be thought of as a tiny vibrating object rather than a zero-dimensional point. Like notes on a cello string, vibration modes produce different particles, electrons, photons, and perhaps gravitons. Strings can split and combine, appearing as particles emitting and absorbing one another, and explaining the standard model of particles. If the theory is right, it carries the promise of more dimensions than the four space-time dimensions with which we are familiar. These tightly curled dimensions are undetectable since they are smaller than the Planck length. There were different versions of the string theory, depending on the type of string and whether or not supersymmetry is incorporated. Despite the specifics, five theories emerged, each with the same concept but differing mathematical models. They were different flavors of the same thing and are collectively referred to as M-theory. Because there is no known way to probe distances of the Planck length, experimental verification of these strings remains daunting, but exciting new prospects to verify supersymmetry and indirectly detect the curled up dimensions might rewrite the universe.
Okay, so that's one summary of string theory, and the other one, which won the first prize, is this one.
In our basic understanding of physics, objects are made of atoms. Each atom contains subatomic particles, called fermions. But what makes up these particles? Let's examine a physical string. It can vibrate at different frequencies, producing a range of different notes. Now, imagine a string a billion times smaller than an atom. When it vibrates, instead of making a sound, it manifests as a particle. One frequency produces a neutron. Another, a proton. What happens when these particles change or interact with each other, as in the beta decay of a neutron? Physicists use the properties of strings to model these interactions. Strings also manifest as force particles, called bosons, that produce the effects we know as gravity, electromagnetic force, and the strong and weak nuclear forces. By following the math, physicists discovered that strings occupy space, time, and an additional 6 or 7 higher dimensions. While it is difficult to imagine something that exists in 10 or 11 dimensions, this framework may be the best way to describe the behavior of forces and particles in our universe. Movement of a string in one of these extra dimensions may produce effects we can measure, such as the spin or charge of a particle. The overall energy of string's vibration determines the mass of the particle, given by Einstein's famous equation E equals mc squared. Physicists hope that their model will someday lead to a theory of everything that encompasses the four fundamental forces and all the known matter in the universe. Strings would then be the basic element that underlies all of physics and explains every previous theory in a new, comprehensive model.
Okay. So that's very good summaries of what string theory is and what it tries to achieve. Now, so there was this competition by Discover magazine, and so the judge of this competition, as far as I could make out, was Brian Greene. This Hollywood movie star, string theorist. So he actually acted in a Hollywood movie. I forgot what the name of that movie was. Okay. So let's continue with some serious summary. An Anybody who can recognize those three people? I would expect not. Okay, so those three people are three very important people who contributed in a very fundamental way to string theory. The person on the left is Gabriel Veneziano. So Veneziano actually should be credited with the person who invented string theory, I suppose. And the person in the middle is Pierre Ramond. So he's responsible for introducing supersymmetry in strings. And the person on the extreme right is John Schwartz. He was actually one of the people responsible for the first string revolution. Okay, so here is a freely vibrating closed string. And in some units where I have set the string length to 1, the tension is of order 1. And on the right, you can see two closed strings joining up, forming an intermediate closed string, and then splitting back into two more closed strings. So this is a picture of the interaction of closed strings. And the strength with which these closed strings interact is called the string coupling. And it is frequently denoted by G sub S, G string. Physicists, string theorists don't have much of imagination, I suppose. And these kind of interactions actually lead to modifications of Einstein's general relativity. So you may have heard that Einstein's general relativity emerges out of the equations of string theory. But if that was it, that you're just reproducing whatever you know, then it would not be particularly exciting. But what happens is string theory leads to modifications of Einstein's general relativity. In a sense, it gives rise to modification to Newton's laws, the famous 1 over r square laws. These modifications, in principle, could be tested in a lab, but the corrections are so small that we don't have so much precision in our equipments as yet. Okay. So the second concept that I wanted to introduce is these things called D-brains. So D-brains are essentially planes on which open strings can end. So closed strings can move around anywhere. But open strings are just restricted to move on these planes called D-brains. And unlike a fundamental string, whose tension is of order 1, the tension of a D-brain goes like 1 over G-string. So when this G-string is small, so when the coupling constant is small, these D-brains are very massive objects. So the picture on the right is supposed to describe an absorption of closed string by a D-brain. And on top, I have given the pictures of the essentially the inventors of D-brains. The person on the left is Joe Polchinski, who came up with the essentially the interpretation of D-brains. And the person on the right is Michael Green. So he formed a collaboration with John Schwartz, and he was responsible for the first string revolution. But he also worked on ideas related to D-brains much before anybody else. OK. So using these D-brains, one actually comes up with a microscopic description of black holes. So essentially, when this G-string is small, you have this nice description using these D-brains. You've got these D-brains, and you've got open strings, which are ending on these D-brains. And because these are massive objects, they are going to curve space-time. And if you have the right configuration, they're going to give rise to a black hole. And this was a major success because you were able to get precise matching between what the Bekenstein-Hawking area law predicted and the statistical state counting that came from string theory. And so the people who were responsible for the first time to achieve this, those in the picture, so the person on the right is Andrew Strominger, and the person on the left is Andrew Strominger, and the person on the right is Kamran Wafa. Both are professors at Harvard. Okay, so you can actually do better. You can pursue this idea more, and you can understand more about the physics of black holes. And one of the physics that you must have heard of is that black holes radiate. They give rise to Hawking radiation. And that's actually one of the ways that you detect black holes. And this Hawking radiation can also be modeled using string theory. So essentially what's happening in that cartoon is that two open strings are coming, joining to form a closed string and leaving the brain. And this is to be perceived as Hawking radiation. Okay. So here is a bit of a technical slide, but I won't spend much time on it. So as you have heard from this beautiful summary videos, that there are these five different kinds of string theories, each have their specific properties. And you could be worried that, which theory am I supposed to use to describe black hole physics or nature for that matter of fact. So this was solved, this puzzle was solved by inventing this thing called M theory. So M, nobody knows what M stands for, by the way. So M could stand for mystery, it could stand for mother, nobody knows. It could stand for membrane, for that matter of fact. So M theory, and so the proponents of M theory were these three people on the top right. The person on the left is Ed Wheaton. He is considered by many to be the smartest theoretical physicist around. The person in the middle is Paul Townsend. He's a faculty in Cambridge in England. And the person on the extreme right is Chris Hull, who is in England, in Imperial College in London. Okay, so this is a picture that you may have seen, that this web. So this is supposed to be M theory, and all these five different kinds of string theory comes when you consider various limits of M theory. And there are these dualities which I mentioned, which relate each of these theories to one another. So depending on the parameters that you're interested in, you can use any of the theories to do a calculation. Okay, so this actually completes my summary of string theory ideas. And I'll move on to introducing the concept of holography. Okay. So the first important thing to realize is that black hole physics tells you that information spreads on the black hole horizon. So before I go on to explaining this slide, I thought I'll show you the pictures of two very famous people. The person on the right is who? Yeah, the person on the right is Stephen Hawking. So he is actually there in that picture. He's taking a zero gravity flight. In fact, this picture was taken from last year. He wants to go to space. And so there's this firm called Zero Gravity in America, which essentially sends some kind of a shuttle over the Atlantic. And in various intervals, time intervals, it's able to simulate zero gravity. Person on the left, any guesses?
No. Person on the left is
B of BH, Bekenstein. And together they gave this idea of black holes having entropy. And this fact that black holes have entropy and the entropy goes like area has led to some profound consequences in physics. And that can be understood as in the following way. So conventional quantum mechanics tells us that the smaller distances you want to probe, the higher the energy that you want to use. Okay, so that tells you that the quantum energy that you want to use goes like h bar c divided by the distance scale that you want to probe. However, when you introduce black holes into the picture, this story receives a dramatic twist. So because far above this Planck mass, high energy collision will create a black hole of mass of the energy scale, energy that you're using to probe the distance scale. What that means is that since the black hole has an event horizon and whatever is inside the event horizon you can't see, there is all the short distance effects will be all hidden behind this event horizon. Okay, so you are trying to probe with a lot of energy, but then that energy being restricted to a certain region in space collapses and results in the formation of a black hole. And the black hole is cloaked by an event horizon. You can't see anything within the event horizon. So all the distance scales that you can probe will have to be greater than the radius of this Schwarzschild horizon. Okay, and the Schwarzschild radius. It's given by this formula. And so when you use M is E over C square, you get that. Is that clear? So one way of stating this is that we cannot discover physics at length scale smaller than the Planck length. As the energy of the probe increases, we'll end up probing larger scales and not smaller scales. So the distance that you're able to probe using this high energy will be a bound. It will have a lower bound, and it's given by this Schwarzschild radius. And it follows that's 2g by c square times energy by c square. And also, from quantum mechanics, you know delta E times delta t is roughly h bar. So using that, you actually land up having a new kind of an uncertainty relation when you use that inequality and use that formula, that delta x delta t should be greater than or equal to this 2g h bar by c to the 4. And this 2g h bar can actually be all combined into the Planck length squared divided by the velocity of light. Okay, so what is this uncertainty relation telling us? This is actually telling us, so you know that frequency is like 1 over time. So you bring that on the right-hand side. So that is telling us that the uncertainty in the location of a particle, which is delta x, increases as you increase the frequency with which you are performing the measurement. OK? So this is an example of an UV-IR connection. So it's an ultraviolet infrared connection that controls the relation between frequency and spatial size. So I've just put it in words here. And this also says that the uncertainty in the location of the particle increases as resolving time decreases. So essentially, the picture that you should have is that if a particle is approaching the event horizon, it will spread out because you can't localize the particle near the event horizon. And this kind of a concept is completely unfamiliar in conventional quantum field theory. So if you try to do a calculation in using standard quantum mechanics, you would actually not get this effect. You'd get the effect that the particle is very well localized, and it will not spread or do anything unusual. However, this kind of spreading of information on the horizon is perfectly consistent with string theory. A calculation in using some very simple methods in string theory gives rise to the fact that a string spreads as it approaches the horizon. Okay. So this is one counterintuitive idea that you learn from black hole physics. And another counterintuitive idea that you learn from black hole physics has to do with the fact that the entropy of a black hole goes like the area. So why is this counterintuitive? So let's consider a lattice with discrete up-down spins, and suppose the lattice space was A, so essentially you should think about a grid of this kind. And so there are particles at the intersection of these lattice sites. They'll carry spin up or spin down. And so let the and the lattice space be A. So this is supposed to be three-dimensional. I've just drawn a projection. So the total number of lattice sites goes like V over A cubed. And since you have two possibilities, either up or down, the total number of orthogonal states goes like 2 to the n or 2 to the V over A cubed. OK? So this is the total number of orthogonal states. So this is like omega. So the entropy corresponding to this is just log of omega, which gives you that relation. S is V over A cubed times log 2. So here, you see that entropy, in a simple example, it's proportional to V, it's proportional to the volume, and this is actually usual in quantum field theory. But this intuition actually changes when you consider gravity, as we know, as one can anticipate, because the area of a black hole is proportional to the area. The entropy of a black hole is proportional to the area. Okay. So this, these kind of ideas can give rise to a simple entropy bound, and this can be derived in a very simple way in the following manner. Consider a region gamma. Let its boundary be denoted by del gamma, and let the area of the boundary be A. Let's put some mass in the region, and suppose we don't have enough mass to form a black hole. So initially, let's not put in enough mass so that it forms a black hole. Now, perform the following thought experiment. Throw in some matter so that now you have enough mass so that it just collapses to form a black hole. And as we know, the entropy of the black hole is given by area by 4g. G is the Newton's constant, so this is, I'm using natural units here. But we also know that the second law of thermodynamics, okay, here I should pause and ask, who can tell me what the second law of thermodynamics is? Yes.
Increases.
Okay, fine. As you know, the second law of thermodynamics tells us that entropy always increases. Or in other words, S final minus S initial should be greater than 0. But this actually tells us that S initial should be less than or equal to area by 4g. Okay? This is an example of an entropy bound. So now, here we find that the entropy is actually not proportional to the volume, but it's proportional to the area. So since the area of a bounded region is supposed to be smaller than the volume, you get an enormous reduction in the actual number of degrees of freedom that you can have when you include gravity in a theory. Is that clear? Yes, because it has to be less than that. You can never have entropy that goes like the volume, because it will violate this bound. Okay, so this idea actually gives rise to this holographic principle, and this was first postulated in 1993 by Tuft on the left and Lenny Susskind on the right. And so, as I said, this implies a large reduction in the non-redundant degrees of freedom compared to ordinary QFT. And the statement is that this can be realized by imagining that the degrees of freedom are living on the boundary of this region, such that we have no more than one degree of freedom per unit Planck area, so that bound is not violated. So, in a sense, what this is telling you is that it is possible to describe the physics of what is going on inside the room. So you've got three dimensions, length, breadth, height, and you've got these walls. So it's possible, this idea is telling you, that I should be able to tell everything that is going on inside the room by just considering these walls, or the degrees of freedom that are living on the walls. So this is this famous principle called the holographic principle. So the thing to take home from here is that you have got a theory of gravity that is living in some 3 plus 1 dimensions or d plus 1 dimensions. And this is supposed to be describable by a theory that is living in lower dimensions. I'm not told you what that lower dimensional theory is. So, neither have I told you whether this 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time with gravity, what is the matter content, what are the fields that are there in the theory, what are the particles, and so on. So one has to make this more precise. And a precise realization of this statement is made possible from the mathematics of string theory. And this realization goes by the name of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So ADS stands for anti-d-theta, and CFT stands for conformal field theory. So as you go into do more and more string theory, you'll come up with lots of nice buzzwords, ADS-CFT correspondence, and M theory, and 2A, 2B, and orienti folds, and whatnot. OK, so the precise statement of the ADS-CFT correspondence was made by Juan Maldacena, who was on the right, who was trying to explain something. And the statement is sometimes referred to as the Maldacena conjecture. So this conjecture was made more precise by these people and loads and loads of others. In fact, the original paper by Maldacena has received more than 4,000 citations. And to put that in context, the highest cited paper in physics, do you have any idea what that could be? You would have naively thought it must be Einstein's special theory of relativity or general theory of relativity or something like that. But that's actually not the case, because nobody cites the special theory of relativity or general theory of relativity when they do it. The highest cited paper in physics is a paper by Steven Weinberg called The Model of Leptons that actually gave rise to the standard model. And the story goes that when he wrote that paper, it did not get a single citation for the first 2 years. So the moral is, don't lose heart. And so these people on the bottom slide, so the person on the left is again Ed Wheaton. So you know, this man has a Fields Medal. He's supposed to be the most brilliant theoretical physicist. So he's usually there in most of the things. The person in the middle, so the person to the right of Wheaton is Steve Gubser. He was very young when he actually contributed to this field. And the person then is Igor Klebanov. And finally, the person on the extreme right is Alexander Polyakov. Alexander Polyakov is reputed, is a very respectable string theorist or physicist. And he in fact, anticipated some of these ideas of the ADS-CFT correspondence even before Maldacena did. But yeah, Maldacena was the first person to make the precise statement. So the precise statement is type 2B superstring theory. So this is one of the five different kinds of string theory. In the special background, so ADS 5 cross S5 means you've got a five-dimensional anti-D-Sitta space. Anti-D-Sitta space is a special kind of space-time with negative cosmological constant. It has got a boundary because we want this theory of gravity to be describable by something that lives on the boundary. ADS 5 cross S5, so S5 means a five-dimensional sphere. So it's like a ball. It's just a high-dimensional ball. And this special string theory is equivalent to a supersymmetric. So this curly N equal to 4 means it has got four supersymmetries. D equal to 4, so D equal to 4 means it's living in four space-time dimensions. Supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. So Yang-Mills theory is, roughly speaking, it's a theory that describes gluons. So gluons are these carriers of strong forces. With gauge group SUN, so N here stands for the number of colors. So you have a large number of colors, unlike what you have in the standard model. In the standard model, you have SU3 times SU2 times U1, and the number of colors here is given by 3. So, okay. And this special gauge theory lives on the boundary of ADS5. So this is the statement of the Maldacena conjecture or the ADS-CFT correspondence. So let's just continue trying to explain this ADS-CFT in a bit more detail. So here you have this boundary. So this is like the hemisphere. And this holographic theory describes how quarks and gluons. So I said that it's a gauge theory. Gauge theory describes gluons. And with some more work, you can put in quarks as well. And it describes how quarks and gluons interact on the boundary of an anti-D-Sitta space and how it could be equivalent to particles in this high-dimensional interior space. So here are the quarks and gluons. And you have some other things in the bulk. And you should be able to describe these quarks and gluons by whatever is living in the bulk. So the equivalent description could be very different. Okay, so here, what looks like a gluon could land up looking like some configuration of gravitons or something like that in the bulk theory. So there is a dictionary which takes you from this boundary theory to whatever is going on inside the bulk. Okay, so there is a reason why we still pursue this, what might seem to you very abstract and apparently irrelevant idea, but then I will come to why we are pursuing this actively in a moment. Okay. So quarks and gluons on the spherical surface of the anti-de Sitter space interact to form. So here the purpose of this one is to explain. So you have a lower dimensional theory here, but and it's supposed to be equivalent to a higher dimensional theory. So how do we get this extra dimension out? Is there some intuition that we can gain? How do we get an extra dimension out from this gauge theory? And the answer is in this slide. Quarks and gluons on the spherical surface of this anti-de Sitter space, so the boundary of this anti-de Sitter space is supposed to be a sphere, interact to form strings of various thicknesses. Holographic interpretation of these strings is that in the interior space, they represent elementary particles whose distance to the boundary corresponds to the string's thickness. So you've got a bunch of quarks and gluons. They interact, they form strings. All of these are living on the boundary. And these strings that are living on the boundary have some thickness. And this thickness corresponds essentially to the distance that this bulk field, this dual field that is supposed to represent this boundary field, how far it is from the boundary. Yes. Yes.
So quarks and gluons are represented by strings. But also inside the de Sitter space, there's more strings?
Yes, that's right. So, okay, so so you remember the picture that you have of brains? So there are these open strings that are any on these brains. These open strings fluctuate, and they generate fluctuations of the brain. Okay, and you have closed strings in the bulk. Closed strings in the bulk go and hit the brain and form open strings, essentially. So. The closed strings represent what is going on in the bulk, and the open strings represent what is going on the boundary.
So essentially, you're describing strings by some strings are in the interior.
Yes.
And in doing that, you're describing something in a higher dimension by something in a one lower dimension.
Yeah.
And that way, you're gaining. What are you gaining?
Okay. What am I gaining? Very good question. So. This seems to be a rather complicated idea. What can one possibly gain from that? We'll come to that in a moment. So to summarize, clouds of quarks and gluons on the boundary surface can thus describe equivalent complex objects, such as this apple in this picture, in the interior. And the advantage of this holographic theory is that the interior objects experience gravity. They have gravity in the interior, but there is no gravity on the bulk, on the boundary. And even though distinct gravitational interaction does not exist on the boundary surface. So you have got a gauge theory with no gravity being described by the theory of gravity. Okay, so I have not flashed that slide. So why do all this? And the reason is the following. So using this duality, it is possible to use the string theory to extract information about the gauge theory in a regime where perturbation theory breaks down. So as I said, essentially in more realistic problems in quantum mechanics or quantum field theory, you can only do things perturbatively. You've got an expansion parameter, you've got a lambda, which is called a coupling constant. And it so happens that this coupling constant at low energies becomes very big in the theory of strong interaction. So perturbative quantum chromodynamics is a hopeless thing to do. But when this, precisely in the regime where this gauge theory of quantum chromodynamics becomes strongly coupled, the dual description, the gravity theory, becomes weakly coupled. And we can do perturbation theory in the gravity side. Okay? So you can extract information about that regime in the gauge theory where perturbative calculations are hopeless by doing the corresponding calculations in the dual gravity. Is that clear? In fact, it works both ways. If you wanted to extract some strongly coupled, so you wanted to understand some physics that involved the strongly coupled gravity description, you know that you can't do the calculation on the gravity side. You can actually use the dual gauge theory to try and do the analogous calculation. So this is just if you want some kind of a trick to gain insight into some of the interesting physics which lies at many various energy scales. So for example, you want to understand how bound states are formed, how to calculate the mass of a meson or mass of a proton from first principles in the gauge theory. And there's no way, because at low energies, the coupling constant is big. Okay. So the second application, which people have been very excited about in recent times, has to do with trying to extract useful information about Rick physics. So Rick, any idea? Anybody know the full form of Rick? So Rick stands for Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. So it's a collider in Brookhaven National Lab. I'll come to that in a moment. So one upshot of all this idiosyncratic correspondence and ideas of holography is the following. So you must have heard of the information paradox. Have you heard of the information paradox? Any idea what the information paradox is? Yes.
Classically, you shouldn't be allowed to lose information in the universe, but anything that gets sucked into a black hole is effectively removed from the universe information-wise.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that's more or less correct. Not just classically. If you use quantum mechanics, okay, you have unitary transformation. So essentially, you shouldn't be losing information. So that is, I think, nicely summarized by this cartoon. You throw in whatever papers you're writing inside a black hole, and it'll never come back to you. So this goes by the name of the information paradox. This was first postulated by Stephen Hawking. And this has got a nice resolution if you believe this idiosyncratic correspondence or ideas of holography. And the statement is that Stephen Hawking showed in the 1970s that black holes have a temperature and give off radiation, and this is thermalized. But physicists have been deeply puzzled because this temperature is a property of a collection of particles. What is the collection that defines a black hole? And the holographic theory solves this puzzle by showing that a black hole is equivalent to a swarm of interacting particles in the boundary surface of space-time. So the key idea, which actually gives a heuristic explanation or heuristic resolution to the information paradox, is that this boundary theory is a unitary quantum field theory, and anything that is unitary will not lose information by definition. Okay. So the other thing that I wanted to tell you about has to do with the Rick physics and ADS-CFT. As I was telling you, the Rick stands for Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. It's essentially a particle accelerator in Brookhaven National Lab. This is Brookhaven National Lab is in Houston, New York. So what they do there is they collide energetic gold nucleus, and when you collide some particles, you get some new particles forming in the center of mass energy. Okay, and so this is a computer simulation of what happens in this when you collide gold nucleus. You get a swarm of quarks and gluons. So gluons carry carry colors, so you get these colored red, blue, green objects that come out. And physicists think that the result of this collision is a plasma. So you have quarks and gluons, free quarks and gluons that form a kind of plasma. And as you all know, you're supposed to think of plasma as some kind of a liquid, and liquids have viscosity.
water has viscosity, honey is more viscous than water, got a viscous coefficient that's bigger. And this viscosity can be calculated theoretically, and it can be measured experimentally. So you've got, so there's a way to check what you get from theory with what you get from experiment. So okay. So as I said, there are some regimes where doing calculations using just standard tools is hopeless because this coupling constant is big. And this is exactly one of those situations where this happens. And then you could hope to do some kind of a calculation using this dual description, which makes calculations your life easier. So in a special example, or in a special version of this duality, these four young postdocs did a very nice calculation, which since then has generated a lot of excitement. And they calculated the ratio of the shear viscosity to the entropy density. And they found that string theory predicts that this is going to be just 1 over 4 pi. And 1 over 4 pi is roughly 0.08. Whereas if you did the same calculation using standard existing techniques, using these perturbation methods, you get an answer that is bigger than 1.6. Then you look at experimental data. Experimental data actually tells you that this eta over s thing, this ratio of shear viscosity to entropy density, should actually be less than 0.3. So standard techniques are hopeless, whereas string theory supposedly gives you a quite nice and possibly more correct answer than standard techniques. So the person on the left, lower left corner, is Andrei Starinets. He used to be a postdoc at Perimeter Institute till last year, and he is currently faculty in England. So let's summarize. So in this lecture, we have learned a bit about holography ideas in gravity. We've introduced concrete realization of this holography idea by talking about the ADS-CFT correspondence in string theory. And we've also learned about a few applications, although I've not told you anything about the mathematical details, which are themselves the subject of many, many, many lectures. So I thought, let me conclude by flashing a slide about the Perimeter Institute string theory faculty and what they are interested in. So this is Rob Myers. You may have attended a lecture by him. He's interested in gravitational aspects of string theory and applications of the ADS-CFT correspondence to strongly coupled quark gluon plasma, very much like the calculations of the shear viscosity to entropy density. This is Jama Gomez. He is interested in understanding the holographic dictionary and non-perturbative aspects of VH theories. So Jama wanted to look young in his photograph, so this is a picture taken from 2000. This is Freddy. You know, all know and love him. So he is interested in developing new tools to understanding of perturbative gauge theories with an idea to apply to the ADS-CFT correspondence. And this is Alex Bushell. Alex is interested in working on string cosmology and trying to understand what is inside a black hole. He probably hopes to undertake some experiments real soon. And he's also interested in applying the ADS-CFT methods related to strongly coupled quark gluon plasma. Finally, some homework problems. So any solving any of them or writing a nice paper on any of them will give you a very nice faculty position with tenure and a lot of salary in some very nice place. So the first problem is find the gravity dual for QCD. And second problem is find a way to compute 1/n corrections. So this is essentially calculating G string corrections to various quantities using the ADS-CFT correspondence. Third is make some prediction using the duality, which you have no hope of realizing using standard methods. And the fourth, and most important, and what might strike a bit alarming, is you have to prove the duality. So as I said, the statement of the correspondence goes by is also known by the Maldacena conjecture. So we have overwhelming evidence that this conjecture is true, but there is no mathematical derivation of this conjecture to date. With that, I'll stop and ask if you have any questions.
Yes. Maybe you could just clarify one of these simple arguments, the one about the black hole and the information. So if I take a page from a book and I throw it in the black hole, I lose the information. If I take a page out of a book and throw it in a fire and it burns, I lose the information too. So, but there's obviously something profoundly different between those two cases, or people wouldn't be making such a fuss about it. But at the naive level, it seems that in both of those cases, I lose the information. I certainly can't get the book back if it's been burnt.
Yes. If you knew the, the burning of the paper is like a chemical reaction going on. So in principle, you have the techniques using, you have the necessary tools at hand to actually reconstruct from the burnt shards what actually went in. Although, by looking at the one chart, you wouldn't have any hope of doing anything.
Seems to suppose that I can make entropy go backwards and so on. As entropy goes up when I burn the book.
Yes, but I guess the difference is that.
I mean, the book really burns. The atoms disperse.
Yeah. So you have
the amount of.
You have the in principle. Yeah. So I'm not saying that you'll be able to do it in practice, but in principle, you have the necessary tools to reconstruct whatever you burn. Whereas here, you don't have the by just starting radiation, or at least using existing. So without using string theory or ADS-CFT, if you tried to understand what came out of a black hole, you wouldn't be able to calculate backwards and ask what went in. So it's a heuristic.
Right, but I mean, if I was going to follow all the atoms, I would have to follow those momentum and positions
yes.
very precisely,
yes.
probably beyond what quantum mechanics would allow me to do.
I suppose that's a question of whether you can do it in principle rather than in practice. But here it is not a question of principle.
Violates an uncertainty principle. It's kind of a question of principle.
Isn't it a question of when you go from a macroscopic level into the quantum level? I mean, your argument becomes whether the fire is going to break it down to a level that you are getting to quantum mechanics. Because within the classical framework, if you're using all classical theory, they're all entirely deterministic. And it should be able to go reverse
the atoms, but the fire burns it into atoms, and the atoms go their merry way. Atoms of carbon and hydrogen, and that was the book. These atoms just go out into the world.
Yeah. No, and I'm saying, does the fire burn it down? Like you're saying, does the fire move it to a quantum process, or does it move it in, does it keep it in a classical regime? And then it's more of a question of kind of a scaling problem?
I guess, but at an operational level, I can certainly make the fire burn it down into atoms. That's not a problem. Okay? So it turns the book into just a bunch of atoms. And those atoms go their merry way now. To reassemble those atoms into the book, I would have to perhaps know their positions and velocity really, really, really precisely. And I'm not sure quantum mechanics would allow me to do that. After all, the atoms go off into the
But then matter remains, right? I mean, it's not like the black hole and the thing is gone in and you lose.
No, but the black hole, not really. So the black hole evaporates, and so whatever made the black hole, it evaporates and it's supposed to give off radiation.
So
the question is whether you can actually reconstruct what went into the black hole by studying this radiation. So the original answer that Hawking gave was no. But then the answer that string theory or ADS-CFT correspondence gives you is yes, you can.
But it is curious, right? Because, I mean, I throw the book into a fire, which is at a given temperature, and out come the atoms at a given temperature, in the same way that out of the black hole comes the Hawking radiation at a given temperature. It doesn't superficially, this is not my field, but superficially, it does not seem that different.
But if you put the book into the black hole, it gives off radiation, right? So the radiation, is that a component of the book, or is that just a reflected image?
Yeah, so the original answer was that from the radiation that you got, you wouldn't be able to construct a unitary backward evolution to get. So what you do in quantum mechanics is you have a wave function. The wave function is moved forwards in time by some unitary operator. And then, so whatever comes out, in principle, you can use the inverse of this transformation to extract what went on at times in T minus T.
Yeah, so you can get the information about it, but with the atoms, is it more that it's like
So that's what I'm trying to say, that the unitary transformations that goes on into burning something, it's still supposed to be a unitary transformation.
Yeah.
Okay? But then what this black hole physicist is telling you is that it's not a unitary. So what Hawking originally told you is that it's not a unitary transformation. You simply have no way of doing it.
Right. Now, it's very difficult to describe the macroscopic world with just unitary transformations.
Yeah, that's right.
But anyway, thanks very much. I see the point now. I see the point of the argument. Now, I'm not sure I'm any more convinced.
Okay.
So back to the holographic theory. You have the boundary, and that's where the quarks and all that jazz is represented by the strings, right? So you have the De Sitter space inside. So at that level, if you're speaking in terms of quantum mechanics, what type of mathematical basis is that? Like, is that a certain type of Hilbert space that everything that exists in? And then you perform, like, is there such thing as operators?
So from the perspective of the gauge theory, you have a way to write on operators.
Okay.
And so essentially, so to give you a rough flavor of what's going on is that, so you have these operators which describe quantum states on the gauge theory, and so you want to find out how these states are interacting. So you need to calculate something that's called a propagator or a Green function. So essentially it tells you how these various objects are correlated. And so what this mapping tells you is it gives you a prescription to actually calculate these correlations using the gravity theory. So there's a mapping between all these operators and with objects that are living in the gravity theory. And secondly, there's a prescription that tells you how to calculate these correlations. So when one talks about solving a theory, or solving a quantum field theory, it essentially means getting all these correlation functions of whatever Green functions. Yes. So somebody else? No, you.
Yeah, the calculation of shear viscosity.
No. So it's certainly not an experimental verification of string theory, but I would say it's an evidence that this gauge theory that we have a nice description of using string theory may be in the same quote-unquote universality class as quantum chromatographs. It's certainly not an experimental verification.
Yes, just a brief clarification. Earlier on in the slides, you showed the Hawking radiation as being actually the ejection of a spray. Wouldn't that be giving the black hole actual finite diameter then by having it be greater than Planck length?
Yes, it is. So the black hole has a finite diameter. So classical GR tells you that you have a singularity that is surrounded by an event horizon. So somehow it prevents you from asking such questions as to what is going on.
Yeah.
How do you understand what's going on inside?
Basically, at the center, it is just a gigantic collection of strings, and I just completely type it back.
Yes. That's what you're supposed to visualize. I mean, it's a very good question. It's, in fact,
as to the best of my knowledge, there is no precise answer to this question as to how these things are actually distributed inside the black holes, where they are living, how precisely to answer this question. It's something that people are.
Is there any possible way, like, how could you determine how strings are oriented inside a black hole when you can't even extract information from inside? Like, it seems like it's a problem that will never be solved.
Okay, so that's a very good question. In fact, so that actually takes me a bit away from the topic of what I spoke on. So imagine you have a gas. So it consists of molecules, the gas's temperature, and so on. Okay? And currently there is an idea which actually tries to think about black holes precisely very much analogous to this gas. So if you knew all the positions of these molecules, so if you knew whatever molecules are inside, you consider an ensemble of these, that statistically that's supposed to give you some kind of a temperature. So correspondingly, there's an idea which tells you that black holes themselves are made up of so black hole is essentially a solution to Einstein's equation. It comes from a matrix. So there's an analogous idea which tells you that this metric actually is just nothing but an average of several metrics. So there are several other states, microstates, and each of these microstates is associated with a metric. And when you consider a whole collection of such objects, in fact, there's a twist to the story. Each of these objects has no horizon, but somehow when you superpose them, you get a horizon. So once that story comes to fruition, you should be able to, I suppose you should be able to answer such a question. Yes?
I was going to ask, if a black hole is consistently emitting hot radiation, what would happen if it was isolated from all other matter? Would it continue to emit this radiation until it evaporated?
Yes.
But then at some point, would it sort of go below the mass level necessary to be a black hole? Or would stars of a certain mass or whatever hypothesized to collapse into a black hole, and then that's what makes a black hole. And if they're below that mass, they won't be a black hole, it'll be something else. Would a black hole eventually emit enough matter, I guess, to cease to be a black hole? Or would it continue to be a black hole until it disappeared to nothing?
I have to admit, I don't know the answer. Yes.
I'm just like redirection of the previous question. So when a black hole radiates, does it decrease in area? Like, its surface area decreases as well?
So it loses mass.
Yes.
And so the area of the event horizon is supposed to be given by 2gm by c squared. So yes.
So
no, but it does not give rise to a contradiction to the second law of thermodynamics, because you have to take into account the entropy of the radiation as well. So the total entropy has to increase.
Right, but it's since its short star radius keeps on decreasing, so the event horizon increases. So I guess it cannot go beyond the mass to like it has to whatever mass it has left has to be encapsulated in an area that actually forms a black hole, according to the theory, right?
So no, I think that's because so the Schwarzschild black hole is supposed to be, you know, it does not represent a formation of a black hole or an evaporation.
Sorry.
It's not a very good example to have in mind when you're talking about evaporation.
Okay.
So, but then your point being that.
Well, I was kind of trying to realize what you're saying, because you're saying if you evaporate enough mass so that the formation of black hole is not possible. But I'm saying like it's just evaporating, but it's also decreasing in the area, so you always have the ratio such that it keeps on being a black hole, right? Because we can form miniature black holes, if I'm not wrong.
Yes, but eventually you won't have anything left, so it will continue. So as its mass gets smaller and smaller, it radiates even faster.
Right.
and it'll just.
So I mean, one of the important questions to understand is what happens to the single entity. So I don't know what the answer to that is. Anything else? Okay.